All right, everybody, thank you for joining us today. We got Jeff Driscoll here with us, and I'm excited to have you on, Jeff. Good to see you joining us virtually. It's the first time we've done a virtual one, so I'm glad you took the time. Thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah, man, thanks for having me. It works well with my three kids at the house, you know. It's a tough sell to the wife to travel anywhere during the off season.
Yeah,
she needs all the help that she can get.
We made an exception for you. So, for those of you who don't know Jeff and what he's about, I took this off your LinkedIn, Jeff, so I hope that's fine. But he's a 9-year NFL veteran at quarterback. He led the University of Florida to the 2013 Sugar Bowl, wrapped up his college career at Louisiana Tech, throwing for 4,026 yards and 27 touchdowns. This isn't all on his LinkedIn. I grabbed some stuff off Wikipedia, too. So some of this stuff, this is Wikipedia, right? So you can correct it if it's wrong. The 207th draft pick by the 49ers in the 2016 NFL draft. Fun fact that Wikipedia said that they traded Vernon Davis and got that pick, and that's how they picked you. Did you know that?
I did not.
This will
take it, though.
Hey, that's pretty cool.
A one-for-one trade with Vernon Davis? That's pretty cool.
That's how they picked that up, your draft pick up, supposedly. Again, per Wikipedia, so this is not
when you get that low in the draft, things happen quick. You know?
Right. he's most recently a quarterback of the Washington Commanders. He's started the Four Pillars Group in 2023 and attempts to acquire small cash flowing businesses in multiple different verticals. He's passionate about small business and the people that operate them. Four Pillars Group exists to help retiring owners transition their business to the next generation. They successfully acquired their first small business in 2023 with an operating partner who handles the day-to-day. Jeff's a board member who assists with the high-level decision-making. And I know you're working on an acquisition right now as well, right?
Yeah, man. I think Wikipedia nailed it.
that
was pretty good.
Yeah. Well, we don't know if the Vernon Davis thing is true. I thought it was a fun fact for the people that follow this stuff. But did you start in the Sugar Bowl?
I did. So that was my sophomore year. We had a great year that year, and this was way back. I'm dating myself. This was before the college football playoffs. So
yeah,
had the playoff been around, we would have been in. We were the number three national, nationally rated team. And I did. I started that day, and Teddy Bridgewater was the quarterback at Louisville, and he made a bunch of money that day. They got after us pretty good.
Well, you did pretty good for yourself after that as well. So what's it like? What comparables are there to being a starting quarterback in the Sugar Bowl and starting a company like the Four Pillars Group?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, I would say there's more differences than similarities. Playing at the University of Florida, there's so many resources available, right? Like, if you have a question, if you need anything, there's someone there to help you out, right? Like, there's so many boundaries and guidelines that they have at places like that, huge companies, talking about the University of Florida specifically, always somebody there to lead you in the right direction. When you're starting something up with you or a couple guys, right? Like, you have to figure out ways to keep yourself in the boundaries and going in the right direction and not going from shiny object to shiny object. So I would say there's more differences than similarities. I would say the biggest similarity is they're both really freaking hard.
Yeah, for sure. what made you, so since they're both really hard, and obviously now you're at the NFL level, I mean, how have you, I guess, number one, why did you want to take this on right now and start the Four Pillars Group while you're still grinding away in the NFL? And then number two, I mean, how do you find the time to do it all?
Yeah, so I'll go back to your first question, is why now? So I fell in love with the asset class, small business investing, a couple years back, self-educated, for about 6 months to a year, jumped on a bunch of calls with exploration calls with people, probably 100 people. Hey, am I thinking about this right? What industry would you go into? If you're in my shoes, what would you do? And these are all people who have done it time and time again. And kind of was like, man, this is really where I want to be after football, but I don't want to wait, right? I want to get involved now. I wasn't so naive to think that I could go run an operating business, while I'm playing football. That's just, unrealistic. So I went out and had a conversation with my brother, caught him at the right time, said, hey, this is kind of how I've been spending my days in the off season. I'm going to get involved in this in some way, shape, or form. I just got to find the right opportunity, and caught him at the right time. He was working in the corporate world, making a nice paycheck, had a nice position, but said, hey, I don't see myself doing this forever. you know, let's figure out a way to work together. And we went out and bought an accounting and bookkeeping firm, and he runs the day to day, and I help with special projects, right? There's not like I have this one hat for, you know, our accounting and bookkeeping company. It's, hey, what needs are there right now, and how can I help out? And most of the time that's with connection, sharing resources, you know, with a network, you know, and, you know, passing some leads over to him. But at the end of the day, it would say, I want to start now, and I want to partner with somebody that I trust. And who do I trust more than my brother? And, you know, it doesn't hurt that he's one of the smarter dudes that I know.
So is it just you two that are the founders and owners, or do you have another partner besides that?
Nope, that's it.
That's
It's
sweet.
just us.
Keep it
It's
in the
just
family.
us. That's right.
That's awesome. I
That's
think it's
right.
sweet. I have so much respect for you, and like I love talking. Last week we had Chris Wormley in the studio, and you know he's similar. He's got 13 apartments, or you know he's got a you know a small real estate portfolio that he's starting, and you know he's ambitious there. Obviously with Alex Erickson, he's been on the podcast. I love talking to athletes who are. Because I know how much athletics helped me be that foundation, and what I was able to do was roll over everything that I did in athletics, the work ethic, the mindset, you know, the sacrifice, all that stuff, and I was able to roll that over into real life. And so I love talking to guys like you, who kind of have that same mindset too. And you start to find this, you know, transition, this transition before you're even done, so that way when you do hang it up, hopefully it's a little bit easier of a transition out of there. And number two, not only do you protect and keep the money that you've made playing 9 years in the NFL, hopefully you're, you know, doubling, tripling, quadrupling that going forward, and you know, you're leaving a real legacy behind you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of similarities. Now, earlier, your question, like, what's the difference between football and, or what's the similarities between football and Four Pillars Group and starting up? Like, there is a lot of similarities, right? And I think, you know, talking about athletes, a lot of us that are in athletics still and haven't really transitioned into the professional world, like, we're nervous, right? Like, how are these skills that we've acquired, how do they transition, right? Because it's not the hard skills that we have. Like, we have hard skills in one thing, that's playing sports. But we do have these soft skills where if we can like channel them in the right direction, they can pay off in a big way, you know, just like you've said. But a lot of guys are really nervous about, you know, am I channeling what I've learned in the wrong places at the right time or at the wrong times with the wrong people? So I think there's a level of like looking for mentors that have done it before and bouncing stuff off of them. Hey, am I looking at this the right way? Because it is, it's intimidating going from, you know, competing at the highest level, to, hey, I got to figure this thing out, and there's really nobody that's going to do it for me. I got to go do it by myself, and you know, gonna have to figure it out.
Do you have, because you've kind of made this jump, are you a guy that a lot of other guys in the locker room kind of look to and ask questions about different, just maybe what they could be doing with their money or what they should be doing with their money because of some of these actions that you've taken?
Yeah, I mean, we have conversations all the time. And you know, it's the people that are asking the right questions are the people that are serious about at least educating themselves and moving in the right direction to make informed decisions. But you know, these conversations are happening all the time, and there is a lot of want for not just yield, right? As looking at people as investors, like, yes, they want yield on their cash, but they also have know that there's going to be so much like energy left after they're not playing anymore, that they want to do well in their next chapter. So there is that fear of like, I don't want to settle. I want to continue to do really well and compete and perform at the highest level. So I think that's in the back of a lot of guys' minds is like, how do I continue to perform on the highest stage and not just settle for, you know, some job because it's there.
For
And not
sure.
that that's a bad thing, right? That inherently that's not a bad thing, but there's so much like so much competitive drive and so much want to, that I think guys are nervous that they're not going to be able to fulfill that fire in their gut.
That was my concern because I have a competitive problem for sure. I'm competitive in everything I do, and that was a big thing. I think one of the biggest transitions, you know, one of the things on the back end is business tends to be. I mean, I truly believe that everything that I'm buying, you know, real estate wise, most of what we buy, I feel like, is a home run from day one. But, you know, when you go out on a Sunday afternoon, you kind of know what the score is, that final, you have some finality
Right.
to each week within 3 hours, which is a little bit different when, you know, compared to the bookkeeping business that you bought in 2023. It's a little bit of a longer time horizon. And sometimes that's a not getting, you know, sometimes instant feedback can be a tough thing for guys to transfer into real life as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's hard for everyone, not just former athletes, right? That's why there's, you know, EOS is a great operating system that a lot of people work on, because it does really boil down, like, hey, 10-year goal or whatever it might be, 10-year goal down to 3-year goal, down to 1-year goal, down to quarterly goal, down to like, what actual items do I need to do to attain this quarterly goal, which will flow up into my end goal. And it gives you a scoreboard at the end of the week, and it'll let you know, like, did I move in the right direction? And it's hard to like have the discipline and like do that well, because there's a lot of other things going on. But that's something that my brother has really helped me out with, is, hey, there's not a natural built-in scoreboard. You have to like, you have to keep the score as well. Like, yeah, you have to score and keep the score.
Yep. Yep. 100%. So the EOS, what does it stand for again? Operating system, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Are you guys running, that for Four Pillars Group? You run that program, or?
I would say EOS Lite. You know, we're not paying somebody to implement it for us. Like, that's a heavy price to pay. But we're using the fundamentals, you know, that it teaches in the books, and yeah, it's been great for us. So I would highly recommend figuring out some system to keep yourself accountable and keep score, like you said.
Yeah. What was your biggest challenge? That first business, I guess, starting. From starting Four Pillars Group to your first acquisition, how long did that take?
So from when my brother and I sat down and said, hey, let's go buy a business, to, all right, we closed on the business, it probably took 9 months.
Okay. That's pretty solid. It's a pretty good turnaround.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that was after a year plus of like self-education and like, I actually have a plan, not an idea. There was a plan 9 months later, there was a business.
Yeah. And what do you think the biggest challenge was getting that first business for you guys?
Was just a lack of history. Like, you have to be a salesperson when you're trying to buy these companies. You have to be a salesperson to these retiring owners. Like, hey, we are the group to steward your business into the next generation. We're going to take care of your customers. We're going to take care of your employees. And, it's a challenge to tell that story based off an idea. Right? We've never done that before. So now when you go from one business to two, you can actually use experiential knowledge and say, hey, this is what we did with our first acquisition. This was how the transition went. This is what went well, and this is what we would change. So it's a lot easier to tell that story now.
Yeah.
And just like with anything, right? It takes a while to get going. And then once you find your traction, it snowballs a lot faster.
Yeah. So with Four Pillars Group, I mean, are you guys buying businesses with the mindset you're going to hold these long term? Are you trying to roll up some businesses and then have a transaction after 3 to 10 years? Are you, what are kind of some of your guys' objectives and goals from that standpoint?
Yeah. So our goal right now is to buy great businesses with great leaders. We don't have a dedicated fund or anything like that that says, hey, in 5 years, we're going to exit. You know, we want to have multiple exit strategies. We're going to build it like we're going to sell it. But at the end of the day, if we have an asset that's, you know, kicking off a ton of cash, we don't want to sell that and put our money back into something that's not producing as much as that asset did. So we don't have to sell. We're building it like we're going to hold it for the long term, building it like the next buyer wants to see it built, and then just being very opportunistic with, you know, when we do plan to exit. Because, I mean, eventually we will. Just there's no specific timeline.
So the accounting business, with how you guys structured that, is the previous owner still working in that business then currently? Is there an earnout? Or how did you structure that?
No, there's no earnout. They're still working in like the actual labor part of it. And the labor in an accounting firm is doing the CPA work, doing the accounting work, bookkeeping work, whatever it might be for their clients. But as far as like the decision-making, the management, the business part of running that business, that is no longer on their plates. It's, hey, you go be a CPA, and you know, my brother, the day the operator, will worry about running the business.
So,
and that's just for a short period of time until they retire.
Got it. Okay. So the day that you guys closed the business in 2023, they got a check.
Correct.
But they then stay on and they're working for another 2 to 4 years or something like that, and then they'll retire, or is it kind of up to their discretion on when they're going to retire?
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of how long, you know, how long would we want them in there? How long do we need them in there? What's their ideal transition? You know, if an owner said, hey, I'm going to sell the business and I'm moving to Cabo tomorrow, like, we would not be interested in buying that business. There's too much corporate knowledge. that we would not be able to gather during a due diligence period to where we would be comfortable taking over, especially when we're not coming from a specific industry, right? You know, if we were going to go buy another accounting company, that might be a different case. Like, we would probably want a shorter transition period to introduce us to clients, introduce us to the team, and just kind of be a smooth pass off. So it's very dependent on case.
So with, and I'm just thinking about how I buy real estate and the value add deals that I pick up, you know, I'm always trying to obviously increase the top line, increase the bottom line.
Yep.
And what are you guys, I'm assuming that's your goal too, right?
Yeah.
What are you guys doing kind of specifically to be able to accomplish some of those goals in something like an accounting business?
Yeah. So I would go back to, and this is like a guess, right? Going back to your first couple deals that you did, you probably said, if these things will cash flow, if I don't touch them at a certain, you know, threshold, then it's a goodbye. And then I'll kind of figure it out from there. That's where we're at. That's where we're at in our life cycle is, hey, if we can buy this business and if it grows with inflation, if we sell it in 7 years at the same multiple that we got in at, if it gives us a, you know, 30% IRR in invested monies, then hey, that's a good business, right? And obviously, yeah, when we get into the nitty gritty, we'll be able to figure out what the actual levers are. So right now, when we're building out pro formas, it is very much, hey, if this thing just stays the course, if we don't screw it up, it will be a good investment. But then when we start to do add-ons with the accounting company, we'll be able to see like, hey, like these margins are a lot smaller than they should be, or, you know, they're a lot bigger than they should be. Why is the case? So we'll be able to have more historical data from what we've seen in our business.
Yeah, for
sure.
To be
able to say like, all right, we can actually move the needle with this company, you know, due to X, Y, or Z. But
yeah,
when we're first getting in, it's, is this business good right now? And if we sell it, if it looks a lot like it does today, then it's a good buy, then that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, your own data becomes very valuable to you as you go out and find new deals, underwrite them, and find the opportunity. Because
right,
that's what I mean, it's so simple. Like, I'm to the point where, like, buying these deals, I don't even care. Like, the last 64 units we bought, I only got the utility number from the previous ownership because I want to make sure that that's, you know, that number was right on. Everything else, though, I know what it costs for me to operate an asset
right,
just like that, because we've got three other assets that are just
exactly
like that exact asset. And so, you know, I can underwrite with, you know, I'm very, very, very precise and very confident in the number that I'm using for underwriting, which has been a game changer for us because we've been able to be more aggressive that way. And we've been
right,
able to kind of get out of that box of having to be cash flow positive day one. You know, like that one wasn't necessarily cash flow positive day one with how we structured it. And here we are 5 months later. I mean, we got tons of excess cash flow now already. Not even a half year into that project, we're picking off another 54 unit deal with a 20,000 square foot office space, all included as one deal. Same thing. Day one, you know, we're a negative like $10,000 a month cash flow with how we have it structured. Our lender is still good with us doing it and actually gave us
right,
like a basically a reserve account that we're going to fund. They'll fund part of it as well that we can kind of pull on the first few months. But we know if we just turn over seven of the apartments, we're now into the, you know, into the green and rocking,
yeah,
and rolling. Right.
Yeah. So, and you're like going back to when you started, you would have never bought that deal when you first
right,
started.
Right? No, I wouldn't.
You had to build out your own data. You had to say like, okay, I know where I can move the needle. And know where I can't. And, you know, we're in the phase when you were early on in your career was, hey, I got to build out a track record with investors, with banks, with lenders. Right. And then also like you've done it time and time again. So there's credibility that comes with that.
For sure. Yeah. Well, the deals that were negative cash flow day one, I would have adjusted the purchase price to a point where I wouldn't have been the leading bidder because some of these rents are just so artificially low. For example, the 64 units I mentioned, the average rent was $800 to $1,000 a month. Well, we're turning those, we're doing our, you know, gold plus level remodels on those, which is basically touching everything in the units. We're getting $1,690, and I think we're light on the rents because we show up one time and people jump all over. They love the product. Yeah, I mean, I think I, you know, with the rents being artificially low, there would have been another buyer, other buyers that if I was 10 years ago trying to buy these deals, I would have just been too low. And so that's why I'm willing to go cash flow negative day one, because there's a certain, like, almost like a get in price to start playing the game on some of these assets. Otherwise, you just kind of miss out on it. So,
That's where we're at it as well. Like, we're never going to go in and say, hey, we're going to be the highest bidder. We can't be.
Yeah.
There's just what we're buying is what it is, right? We're not the group that's going to come in and, you know, fire the back office because we already have that group. Like, we don't have that. And that's why, you know, private equity gets a bad name, is because that's what they do. And that's why their margins get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they can pay up for these assets. So, we're getting in the game. We're looking for really good assets, with really good people. And, we hope over time that we'll build up a reputation of being a good group to work with, but also, have good results after going full cycle on a few of these deals.
For sure. So you guys, is the bookkeeping business still the only acquisition that you guys have to date?
It's your only holding? It's our only one. We're under contract on a roofing company here in Central Florida. We're hoping that one closes at the end of May. There's a million questions that you have to ask during this process, right? And every day it seems like we're going to close. And then at the end of the day, it seems like the deal's dead. And then we start over. And, you know, just so many things come up during the due diligence process. And, you know, different from real estate is like the people involved, right? There's so many more moving parts, and people to me is what makes it fun. But people also are like wild cards, right?
Yeah.
You have to get comfortable with the person. Or people, and you have to get comfortable with their finances and their product and how they're seen in the community, and, you know, down and down and down the it goes.
For sure. For the people that are looking at maybe buying businesses and stuff, you just mentioned, you know, it seems like, you know, by morning you're on with the deal, by that same night you're off with the deal because of just the things with due diligence. What are some of the things that pop up that make you so hot or cold with that?
Man. So I'm trying to think here. There's so many things. I'm trying to think where to even start. So when you're in your data gathering phase, right, a lot of times these businesses are, there's some type of intermediary. So there's a broker or an investment bank or somebody in between the eventual buyer and the seller. And, you know, the broker is never going to know the business like the seller does. So they're screening potential buyers for, hey, is this person a tire kicker? Is this person ever going to actually close the deal? Okay, like, all right, this person is a real buyer. So then he gives you access. He tells you what, not necessarily what you want to hear, but what he thinks about the company. And then you get on the phone with the seller, and it's a totally different story, right? So you're like, who do I believe here? Who's lying? Is it just misinformation on accident? Is it on purpose? Are they lying to me? You know, is this a red flag for down the line? And then there's just so many things, right? There's never going to be a perfect asset. And, you know, you see it in the buildings that you buy, like when you do an inspection report, it's never going to come back clean. And you have to figure out, like, the hair on the deal, am I comfortable with that? And, you know, the more deals you look at, the more keen of eye you should have when dealing with figuring out, am I okay with this hair?
Well, and again, like even with us in the real estate stuff, there was an acquisition we had where, and we still use a third party vendor for a part of our due diligence as far as when it's like the big, big ticket items. So like structurally and some of the HVAC systems and whatnot. But there's times where like they'll come back with a higher number than, you know, and we know to actually fix that is actually going to cost us less. And I don't know if that's because, you know, we get better pricing from our vendors because how much work we're giving them or whatever now. So there's ways that we can kind of make adjustments like that. But there's sometimes certain things that are a surprise. And again, like you said, you either find, you know, you either got to renegotiate. I mean, I've always found like sometimes my attorneys will negotiate certain parts where if I'm like, dude, I can't deal with this seller anymore or whatever. I'm about like ready to walk away from, like you said, I'm ready to walk away from the deal. Sometimes our attorneys will step in and negotiate parts. I'll just be like, yeah, Adam, you know, go negotiate this part for me. And the thing that I always tell him, and I always remind myself too, is in a worst case scenario, there's always a price adjustment for everything too, right? Because then you can, you know, because of that price adjustment, you can now take care of that problem, or, you know, the cash flow makes sense. So that it just increase your risk and reward and whatnot. So I always think about that. Going back to what you said too, with the businesses, and there's a people component. Are you guys running like some type of cultural assessment Or what does that piece of it look like? Because we don't have to, I don't have to deal with that part of it as much on the assets we buy. We're kind of putting our own people in most of the time. It's rare that we keep a full staff or whatnot. Yeah. So what does that look like on your end?
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, it's a gut feeling right now. I think as we continue to move forward, there will be some type of more formal like vetting process, but right now it's gut, and there's some proxies for, is it a good culture? Right. You know, there's, if it's a service company, right, there should be some type of online presence that they have with reviews. Go read the reviews, right? Are they dealing with just the owner? Are they dealing with, you know, the salesperson? Are they dealing with anybody else? So go in and just read the reviews. Strong reviews, higher likelihood of a stronger brand. How long have the people there been working there, right? How tenured are the employees? If all the employees have been there for less than a year, that's probably not a good sign. If they've been there for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, at the same place, you know, that's a sign of a good culture. But also like getting in front of these people and just having an hour or two and eating lunch with them, like you can figure out a lot in over a beer, and you don't even have to be talking about the actual business. You can just, you know, be talking about whatever, and you can get a good feel if this person is a good person or not. And then you go and you do a quick Google search, you see who their friends are. So it's more of a gut check than anything right now, but there are a few proxies for, hey, is it actually a good culture? Because, you know, these sellers don't want to give access to their employees, right? The last thing that they want to do is, you know, give someone like myself access to their employees. Say, hey, I'm looking to buy this business.
Yeah, right.
And tell me about the culture. Deal doesn't go through, and they're spooked, and they leave, right? So it's challenging to really understand it, but, you know, you look for proxies.
So the bookkeeping business, how many total employees did they have?
Oh, man. I want to say it was, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20.
Okay. So yeah, you guys talked to the owner, and then did you guys talk to, like, any other leadership within the company or anyone else, or just pretty much the owner?
Owner.
Got it.
Owner. So there's always going to be a leap of faith with these things, you know?
So the same thing with the company you have under contract right now, the roofing company, you're pretty much just talking with the owner?
Actually did get access to somebody in a leadership position, which is unique. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with folks, and this has been the most access that we've gotten, which has been great. It's been great to hear it from somebody else. So I was surprised that they gave us access, but it's been very helpful, not just to understand the culture, but also like, get on the same page so that we can hit the ground running on day one and not have to figure out like the ins and outs of how the day works.
For sure. Are you guys looking in specific regions, or are you guys willing to kind of go and buy businesses wherever?
Yeah. So it kind of starts with like, who's going to be running the ship, right? So like when we find someone that we really want to work with, we believe in them. You know, it's really up to them. Where do they want to live? You know, and organically our network is in Florida. You know, with people that we want to work with, but also with intermediaries who are sending deals our way, you know, the closer to home it is, the more conversations you have, the more opportunities that you're going to see. But, we're open to wherever. We've branded ourselves as like SEC country, right? Playing on the football thing. So, you know, with the reorgs of college football, that's, you know, Florida to Texas up to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And who knows where it will expand to, but at the end of the day, we're looking for good businesses, and I don't think it really matters where they are if the operator's willing to relocate.
Yeah, absolutely. I just forgot the question. I had a really good one too.
It was going to be good.
It was there.
Felt it.
Joel, I don't know if there's a camera for you or not, Joel. Joel, do you have any thoughts, comments, questions that you want to add to this?
Yeah, I guess as far as just the different businesses that you're looking into, what are you looking for? Is it certain services, certain industries? Are you looking just kind of whatever seems to feel right for you guys at the time? I know I obviously go from bookkeeping to roofing. It seems like a pretty different, you know, line of business and line of work. What's kind of steering what you guys are looking at?
Yeah. So it all starts with the operator, right? For the first business, accounting and bookkeeping, my brother Jason, he came from a white collar background. You know, he worked in the corporate world where, and I'm sorry, my daughter's sitting here banging on the door. So go ahead. So he was comfortable in that white collar environment. So he wanted a company with a white collar workforce. He wanted something with very recurring revenue. He's a little bit more risk averse. He's an engineer by education, so he's relatively risk averse. So he wanted something that wasn't going to take off like a rocket ship, but something that was reoccurring with sticky customers. So when you look at those, like, it led us straight to bookkeeping and accounting. And then when we're looking at roofing, the guy that we're working with grew up, his dad was a contractor. He got a finance degree at UCF and literally paid his way through college on roofs, like laying shingles. When he got done with his degree, he said, "Hey, I want to stay in construction, but I got this finance degree. I'm not about to be the labor." So we got a project management position. So he knows that world inside and out. We're comfortable with him. We think he'll be a great operator, someone who we really are excited to work with. So we said, "Hey, let's look for something within an hour of Orlando, you know, in the roofing or windows and siding spaces." So it's really operator driven.
I think the whole roofing and exterior, I mean, I know the one of the companies that we use that do that, they probably do, I don't know, 60%, 80% of our exterior roofing siding work up here. They've blown that business up, like blown it up. I think they've had it open for like 10 years, but I think they're, I don't know, they got to be approaching like $25 million, $30 million a year of revenue already now, and just rocking and rolling with what they're doing. They do a great job with their sales. They do a great job with their marketing. Yeah. They provide, you know, they do great. They're great at communicating with their customers, like with us and our team. I mean, with what's going on and whatnot, and they do good work. And
yeah, it's a marketing and service business.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And the widget happens to be roofs or windows and siding or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the big thing about roofing too, what's nice is it's a fast contract cycle. I know that's one thing in the building space that we're fighting a lot right now, is it's a really long duration. So you have retainage, typically a 10% retainage. We could sit on that for a year and a half, just depending on the cycle. So yeah, it really holds up your cash flow a lot of times.
You want to tell, yeah, you want to tell Jeff what you do real quick, just in like,
yeah,
20
sorry,
seconds.
I work in the multifamily space. So okay, the company that I work with builds multifamily apartments. So okay, we do anything. We kind of focus on the labor side, and anything from framing to finishes, flooring, granite countertops, quartz countertops, cabinet supply, kind of supply, lumber, all the facets kind of in the middle, anything that's non-trade or anything that's, yeah, non-trade related, I would guess.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's very much in our wheelhouse, but again, for us, we're not, you know, we're not doing single family. So you're not knocking that out in 2-3 months, you know, yeah, we're on a project for sometimes up to a year, and it really holds your cash flow. And with roofing, I love that churn, sure, that you guys can get 2-3 days and you're on to the next one, on to the next one, on to the next one.
Oh yeah. And this, the business that we're looking at is strictly residential, non-new construction, do all their roofs, the re-roofs in one day. 40% of the business is the retail model, to where there's no insurance companies involved, lower ticket items, cash conversion cycles quicker. And then the other 60% is where insurance is involved. So cash conversion a little bit longer. The price point's a little bit higher. So it's a good blend of like, keeping the cash in the company, but also making sure that there's more revenue coming in when you get the insurance companies involved. So it's a good blend, but like you said, like having cash available at all times is huge, like the lifeblood, yeah, of any business, right?
Would you end up opening that up to and try to attract some commercial business there? Cause I look at the company that we use again, like one of them, Heinz Contracting is what their name is. And I mean, it's like every like, like right now, it's like every 3 weeks we're giving them another $200,000 to $500,000 to $600,000 contract, and it's just, yeah, like they just like turn us and burn, and then we're always buying. It's like almost like too, as we grow, they grow, because it's almost like a partnership. Do you see that being a thing with the that you'd add on at some point?
Yeah, I mean, there's always like the opportunity cost, right? Like when you look at residential, the margins are higher. That's what
for
the
sure.
That's what the crews do really well. So right, yeah, now.
Makes sense.
As it stands with this business, they do like 5% commercial work, and the work that they do, they're customer facing. So they, yeah, have a subcontractor licensed crew who doesn't want to be customer facing, just wants to do the roof job. And this company handles the customer facing service piece. So I think that would be a good avenue for growth, is if we can really find some subcontractors that we really believe, yeah, in and trust. Because at the end of the day, even if we're not doing it, it's our brand that's gonna, sure, either, you know, be elevated or take a hit if things go good or bad. So I think there is room for that. But it also is hard to go away from the bread and butter, right? Do what they're really good at.
Yeah. If you guys pick up, you know, as you guys pick up more businesses, is it a requirement that they then use your bookkeeping and accounting firm?
Not a requirement. highly encouraged, right?
Yeah, there you go.
highly encouraged. We'll make sure we get that company to the front of the line.
Absolutely. Sweet. That's awesome, dude. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have much else. Joel, do you have any other questions, thoughts for Jeff right now?
Not offhand. The other comment that when you talked about, it's amazing what you can learn over a beer. And that's one thing in the acquisitions world where it's, you know, deals are done over dinner. Yeah. And it's that relationship piece, and it's that sitting down with people, getting to know them. You learn so much more in the due diligence phase of that than I think a lot of times just cranking through notebook after notebook after notebook. But I guess for you, what is kind of your, do you have any specific targets or goals as far as how many acquisitions you want to make, how rapidly, what's your growth trajectory for the next 5, 10, 15? I guess as you look forward, both professional athlete career, kind of blended with all the other stuff you have going on, I guess, what are you projecting? What are your goals?
Yeah. So our goals are to do 2 deals this year. We have 2 operating partners that we're engaged with, you know, hoping to get the roofing deal to close, you know, by the end of next month, still looking for the right opportunity for our other operating partner. And then we kind of want to slow down and say, hey, how do we support these people really well and make sure these businesses do well, right? We don't know exactly what that support looks like. Like I said earlier, with what I've done with the accounting business, it's, hey, what does this company need right now? So we want to make sure that we have the bandwidth to be able to support those businesses. And right now we just don't know what time requirements there are. So our goal is to do those 2 deals, take a step back and figure out how to support the heck out of them.
Yeah, I honestly think that's a great comment that you had there, because I think there's so many times people just get caught in acquisition mode. And lately, like anyone that's been coming to my masterminds, I mean, you know, the last like year and a half, I've just been hammering, like, talk about operations, because so many times, like, the most valuable thing that you can do is to squeeze as much, you know, lemonade out of the lemon that you've already got in your hand.
Absolutely.
And to make sure that it's running, you know, as well as it can run, and it's, you know, well, it's got all the tools it needs, it's got everything that it needs to be the best that it can. I see it all the time. It's so overlooked, especially in real estate. I think in anything, I think just the operations, you know, are always just so overlooked, especially in like today's world where, you know, on Instagram, social media, I mean, people are always just talking about like an acquisition or, you know, what in the next acquisition and growth that way. But it's like so many people miss out on the growth by, you know, operating, because a lot of growth can come that way.
Yeah, and that's the cheap. That's the good growth. That's the one that doesn't cost you an arm and a leg, right? But yeah, it's one of those deals where, like, selfishly, it's about our reputation. It's about making sure these first few deals go well to where we can have a war chest, you know, down the line where we can go acquire faster and recruit better people because we have, you know, more money to work with. But we also know that war chest isn't going to get filled up if we don't do these first few right.
For sure. The question that I forgot earlier just came back to me. What does the capital stack usually look like for the deals that you're doing?
Yeah. So the deals that we've done so far, we're leveraging the SBA program. So the operating partner is really the majority. Our group, we get a piece of the pie for, you know, finding the deal, raising the capital, putting the deal together, getting it to close. And then there's a management piece of it for supporting it post-close. But on any deal, it could be from 20 to 40% investors' monies. And then, you know, our group and the operator make up the balance. So there's typically around a 2x step up. If we were going to raise 10% in equity, then that investor group would get 20% in equity. If we were going to raise 20%, the investor group would get 40% of the deal, and so on and so forth. And the SBA requires a 10% down payment. And as we continue to do more deals, we hope to graduate from that product because there's a lot of red tape. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of requirements. Yeah. that you have to do to make sure that it's eligible. But we also don't want to lever it to the gills. So the first deal we did 10%. This deal we're doing 20% down payment with a 10%
seller. It's a great way to get
started. With a 10% seller note. Yeah.
It's a great way to get started though. So,
yeah, it gets us in the game.
So I heard you correctly then, that first deal you did 10% down, so SBA loan for 90%, 90% of its debt.
For 80%. I forgot. There's a 10% sell note.
Okay, so the first one, the SBA loan, did an 80% like first position.
Yep.
Seller note of 10%. You guys came up with 10% of the equity.
Correct. And I was the only investor. I was the only investor. I didn't want it. We wanted to like continue to move up market, right? I stroked a check and that gave us a story to go raise money.
For sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
We've done a deal before. We didn't take on any investors. We wanted to make sure we could do it and do it well. You know, we learned this, that, and the other during the deal, but we didn't take on any investors' money. Now, hey, we're doing another small deal. We're going to raise on a deal by deal basis. We're not going to do a fund. We are going to take on some investor money. So yeah.
That's a great way to get started. So, okay. So you see this, so this next one is going to be 80% debt and 20% equity. Is what you're thinking?
10% seller note.
10% seller note again.
70% bank debt.
Okay. And then 20% equity. So now how does this other piece, I think I followed, but I just want to make sure how that 20% equity that you're raising, how did you say the step up works? How did you say that the breakdown?
Yeah. So there's a model. It's called the self-funded search model. And it's kind of like the universally accepted term for
self-funded what?
Search model.
Self-funded search model.
Yep.
Okay.
So it's essentially for people who are looking to buy businesses with SBA debt, right? And who can't come up with the down payment themselves. The investors, you know, collectively put down, call it 10%. They want to take part in this really good debt product. So in order to do that, there needs to be a step up. It can't just be, hey, 10% down, I'm getting 10% of the business. It's universally accepted that it's around a 2x step up.
Okay, so but that 10% is 100% of the money, right?
100% of the equity, correct.
Yeah. All right, so the deal where you just stroked the check, you put in 100% of the equity, and how much of the equity then did you keep of the business?
20%, less than 20%. So in order to not have to personally guarantee any of the debt, you have to stay under the 20% ownership threshold.
Huh. You know about this?
Yeah, I know that's how SBAs work.
Yeah, I don't know enough about it.
There's so much red tape with an SBA that there's a lot of loopholes.
There is.
Like he's talking about.
So you as an individual or your family trust or whatever, you guys own... Why am I getting a thumbs up thing? Like,
I don't know. I've never seen
it. Are we live or something?
Like it must be the way your hand is sitting there. It gives you a thumbs up or a thumbs down. That's annoying.
All right. So you put in 100% of the equity of the bookkeeping business. You own 20% as an individual, right? That's not Four Pillars Group.
That's correct.
All right. Four Pillars Group owns how much of the equity?
Four Pillars Group owns nothing right now.
Nothing. Okay. Then who owns the other 80% of the business?
That'll be the operator.
The operator owns the other 80% for no money in?
For running the business, for having a personal guarantee, right? If it goes south.
They guarantee the loan.
Got it.
They guarantee the loan. But also, if it's a qualified, you know, operator, this person's going to be taking a haircut on salary, right? So there's risk involved as well.
Got it. Okay. No, that makes sense. So now to see that I get this, well, but I guess it changed maybe a little bit now with this next one, because Four Pillars is the goal is to have Four Pillars be involved in the next one.
Right. That's what we're doing. So we'll just use the same thing in a world where, you know, the investors have 10% of the equity for exchange of 20% of the cap stack. You know, the operator now doesn't get 80%. He gets, call it 65%. And Four Pillars Group gets the balance from the operator's piece of the pie, if that makes sense. So we're not going out and saying, hey, investors, if you want to work with us, you need to change. You need to accept terms that are not standard with the self-funded model. It's, hey, operator, if you want to work with us, there's going to be a higher likelihood of a greater outcome. So we need a piece of that for the work that we're doing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's coming from his piece of the pie and not the investor's piece of the pie.
Yeah. Yeah, I neglected to go through the roofing deck that you sent me, and I got to go through that here this week because I think that'll help me understand it a little bit more. But all right, so when you say 10% of equity, though, it's really 100% of the equity that they're bringing, which is 10%.
10% of the project cost.
Yes. So 100% of that equity is for how much of the owner, what percentage ownership of the deal
on 20%. This
roofing? 20%. All right.
But in the roofing deal, it's 20 and 40 and not 10 and 20.
So who is the 40?
The 40 is the investor base, because 20% of the project cost is the investor base. It's coming from the investors.
Okay. Got it. I think I got that. So Joel's running it through his, he's running it through his head.
That makes sense.
So Four Pillars Group will end up with how much ownership?
Call it 15%.
Okay. And then that stays with you guys, or will that be, that just stays with Four Pillars Group? Or is that including, does any of your investors get a portion of that too or not?
No, that's with that's Four Pillars Group.
Got it. Okay. I think that
makes sense. They're getting that piece out of the operator's piece.
Correct.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at the normal self-funded search model, Four Pillars Group is not in that model.
Sure.
We carved out a piece of the operator's pie for doing the work.
SBA is good with that.
Yep. We're under the threshold. Yep.
Got it. Okay. That's an interesting way to do it. I've never heard of that model, and I think I learned something that's pretty cool. I kind of want to look
at it. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So what type of returns do you guys offer the investors that you bring on then? What are you guys typically trying to target?
Yeah. So again, when we're modeling these things out, it's like with inflation, right? I think on the roofing deal, we modeled out like a 3.5% annual increase. So like very, very, very conservative. So if we were going to go sell it in 7 years, and that's an arbitrary number, that's kind of close to private equity, you know, how they model stuff out. If we sell it at the same multiple, we're looking for a 30% IRR after 7 years.
Dude, I think you're going to crush it. If you have operators that have that much skin in the game, none of the operators are only going to want to grow with inflation.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, it's a very not, like, honestly, it's a very non-realistic like model. But what we're buying is these historicals. So if we go in and say like, hey, we've never run a roofing company before, like how could we model it out? And again, down the line, when we have our own data, we can say, hey, if we pull these levers, like this is very realistic, but we don't have our own data yet.
For sure. With your investors, when are they expected? Are you kind of showing and saying, hey, you're projecting that they're going to get cash flow starting when from these deals?
Yeah. So in this one, in our modeling, we basically showed like, hey, half of the free cash flow will get distributed every year starting in year one. But with the caveat saying, hey, we're not just going to return the cash just to do it. If we as a group decide, hey, this cash is better served elsewhere to grow this thing a lot quicker than it is, then we have the right to do so. But we put that in there showing like, hey, we do plan on doing distributions starting from day one, but we're not required to.
For sure. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And what I've been doing, I think it's pretty cool. You did the first one, you just stroke the check and got it rock and rolling.
Yep.
And actually, like, it's kind of crazy too. Like, as I've talked to more and more people, and as I've gotten, you know, we have a ton of investors here, and as we refinance and sell some deals, I mean, I'm looking at it like, man, like 30 to 50% of what I buy going forward, I just want to own outright to have, because like when you see, granted, like I'm making a higher percentage return compared to the money that I have in there when I have other investors. Yes. My cash on cash or my percentage return is greater. Right. But like we actually just look at the bulk, the actual dollars though that get sent out, having a portion, what's really appealing to me is having a portion of my holdings that can just act as a piggy bank for whatever I want to do, whether it's just, hey, put it, we can do whatever we want with that cash and those proceeds. Yep. I think there's a lot of power to that. And that's kind of where I'm at right now is like, okay, like 30 to 50%, like these acquisitions we've had lately, there's like really no investors in there. And so that's kind of a model that we're kind of starting to add to. And, and it's just, I'm kind of excited about it because we're not going to kill our private equity side is, I mean, we've got like 190 different, you know, investor accounts and it's probably like 100 different individuals right now and whatnot. And I mean, it's extremely, extremely profitable. Private equity is like, we're not ever just going to kill that business completely, obviously, but we're just kind of being more selective. And I think actually what will happen is it'll just kind of adjust because I'm not that far from being able to just go buy 300, 400, 500 unit apartment buildings for myself.
And that's so a nice place to be in.
But I think what happens is I think like we'll just end up like there has been deals I've passed on that have been like a 2,000 unit portfolio that's passed me. Well, it's like now we can go after that stuff, right? And the crazy thing is like what I've found is the more of my own money I put into these deals, Jeff, like the more other people want to invest and the higher the demand gets. Like, true. It's crazy because like other people want to now just put a bigger and bigger. They're like, you're putting in how much? I'm like, because most people that are raising money are putting in 0, 1, 2, 3%. So when you go, when you bring something to someone, you say you're putting in 55% of the money. People are like, I want to put in, I want to put in $2 million, right? Like,
which would not happen. Incentives couldn't be more aligned, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's what people are looking for.
Yeah.
Like, and that's huge. And that, I mean, that's what we're doing too. Like, we're putting in a good amount personally, and our monies will get treated the same as any other investor's monies. And again, that's not, it's because we believe in the deal, but it's also to show like, hey, we're not just like getting in this for sweat equity only. Like, there's actual cash.
For sure. What's your wife think about you doing all this stuff? She thinks you're nuts, or is she obviously really supportive, or what, where is she, what does she think about
she,
all this
she
stuff?
She believes in the vision. She believes in the people, like believes in me, believes in my brother. You know, one of these years we're going to have to show her it's not a hobby, not just a hobby. So we're going to have to start knocking some of these things off the board. And, you know, there's gotta be some checks that are coming in, but she believes in us and yeah, she trusts in us wholeheartedly and knows that we're going to make the best decisions for our individual families.
Yeah. No, and that obviously is a complete difference maker when you got all the support in the world at home and whatnot versus, you know, someone trying to drag you down and go the other way with it. So that's obviously huge too. So cool, man. Well, I appreciate you joining, Joel.
Final question.
Yeah, final question. So, Jeff, something that we kind of like to do that we started a handful of weeks ago or a handful of episodes ago is the previous guest leaves a question for the next guest, and then you'll leave a question for the next guest after you answer this question. Okay. So Joel, you got the question up?
So question from the last guest was, if you were in a third world prison, who would be your one phone call to help you get out of the situation?
Oh, man. Third world, my one phone call. All right. I'm going to go with my pastor at my church, David Youth. They have done a lot of work in third world countries. Oh. I think that they would be able to somehow make a connection between, hey, we've helped this many people in this country before, and grace and forgiveness and all of these things. I think that he would be able to do well over the phone.
All right, let's call him right now and see what he thinks about you.
I know this.
Throwing that on his shoulders. I know he'd accept. That's awesome. That's a great answer. I love it. I don't know. It's my turn. I don't know who I'll call for sure. Yeah, it's your turn to ask a question for the next guest.
Oh man. Okay. Jeez. All right. If you were a real estate agent, would you rather drive a tricked out Cybertruck or a sedan? What do you think would help you sell more deals?
All right, cool. I like that. Noted. That's unique too. That'll I like that. Back to back, pretty unique questions there. So awesome, man. I appreciate you joining today. How can people find you and what you're up to and reach out to you to maybe get involved or invest? I mean, we got a lot of people that watch this that might be interested in investing at some point.
Yeah, I'm on all the platforms, LinkedIn, Twitter. You know, those are the easiest ways to connect with me. I think both of them are just like at Jeff Driscoll or whatever. And then people interested in learning about the asset class, like I said early in the episode, like a ton of people poured into me. Like, help me out, like getting my foot in, figuring out the asset class. Happy to have those same conversations with people that are interested, want to learn more. You know, the more exploratory calls, open and doing that. So please reach out. Love talking shop. And yeah, man, thanks for having me on here.
Yeah, cool. And I think I just want to throw this out there too. I like some of your LinkedIn posts. You just kind of share about, you know, what it's like, you know, you kind of shared your journey a little bit and you ask a lot of questions too. And I think I like a lot of stuff that you put out there. So
well, I appreciate that.
You bet. And thanks again for joining. Thank you everyone for watching. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks, guys.